You're listening to, of course, the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and we bring you cutting-edge information. For the last 40 years, we've been together as hosts of radio programs all around the globe, and we're really excited, of course, to start the new year with a great, interesting topic now, psychiatry redefined. So we'll talk about that in a bit. And you can always get more information about our walks and talks and seminars and webinars and fun shops. Because when we're doing our workshops, we don't like to call it work, it's actually like fun. And that's at naturalnurse.com and Dr. Z, D-R-Z, naturally.com. So we're really excited. So along with our guest here, topic is nutritional interventions in psychiatry and mental illness. And I have quite an interesting background myself in that, which is interesting. I had the opportunity to work in my early neophyte training in naturopathic medical school with the late, great Dr. Serafina Corsello, who was a orthomolecular psychiatrist. And she taught me quite a bit about the field. And also the fact that a lot of psychiatry really is based on this whole idea that if we correct neurotransmitters, that we make big breakthroughs, which is, I think, partially true. But if you talk to experts like David Burns, who's author of Feeling Great that we had on there, it's more than that. A lot of it has to do with helping people with cognitive therapy. So there's a big debate in medicine and psychiatry, which came first, the molecules or the actual thoughts. But anyway, we have Dr. James Greenblatt here, who is an acknowledged integrative medicine expert, educator, author, and he wrote a book called Answers to Anorexia, Master the Balance of Hope and Healing, and talked about correction of nutritional deficiencies. And Dr. Greenblatt is a leading contributor to helping physicians and patients understand the role of personalized medicine for mental illness. So we're going to have him on right now. Welcome. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you. It's good to be with you.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Well, tell us a little bit about how you made the jump. I was interested in holistic medicine from the get-go, so I decided to just jump in and become a naturopathic physician. But a lot of people have a more circuitous route where they start with, conventional medicine, and then they kind of make this journey to understand and respect the field of integrative medicine. So tell us a little bit about yourself, Dr. Greenblatt.
Sure. My journey actually started in college. You mentioned orthomolecular medicine. I actually did a research project paper on Dr. Hoffer and orthomolecular psychiatry. And that stirred my interest in medicine. So I was a college junior, and at the time was, vegetarian. And I thought I was going to save the world eating brown rice and kale. And ended up going to medical school and become a child psychiatrist. And I came out, a psychopharmacologist trained in prescribing medications for children. And I quickly realized that wasn't effective consistently, and quickly got back to my roots. I've been practicing over 30 years trying to educate physicians and patients on this integrative and orthomolecular, and I use the term functional, medicine approach to mental illness, mental health.
What do you think about the whole idea of the separation of the mind and body and the history of medicine? I think that's fascinating to talk about, because for some, it's like dentistry. When I talk to dentists, like my dentist, we have these great conversations about how the mouth somehow got separated from the rest of the body, and medicine kind of lost respect for dentistry at some level, I guess, became separate disciplines. Medicine tends to, mechanistic medicine tends to carve people up into different specialty things. The GI person's not talking to the psychiatrist. The, orthopedist isn't talking to the orthomolecular guy. So what's the state of how did all this happen? And, what's your thinking on all that?
Well, I mean, the history of psychiatry is pretty bleak and tragic, as we've never really understood how the mind works or how to treat it. So it's been both from barbaric to simplistic, with this one pill treats all of depression. But yeah, similar to what you described with the dentist, I think psychiatry has forgotten that, you know, we have a neck, and what's happening in the body affects the brain. And that's clearly our message. If there are, you know, nutritional deficiencies, hormone problems, or gut problems, it affects brain function and mental health.
Now, I always, when I talk to my students, train them at the University of Bridgeport Naturopathic College, one of the colleges I helped found years ago, we always talk about, I start my first lecture of the year where we talk about, you know, how principles of holism, and we mention a lot of those factors that you just talked about, like the gut, and how, you know, I show them some of the research on the, you know, effect of casomorphins and gliadomorphins, which are like these kind of opioid-like molecules that are created from reactions to wheat and dairy, and how they actually affect the mind as if the person is on opioids. And we see this a lot, of course, in OCD patients and patients that are on the spectrum. And then, of course, there's other gut-derived toxins and other toxins, too, that are, really aren't gut-derived. Like, for instance, I remember going through the biochemistry, if you're low in niacin, your body will try to make niacin, which is a very important vitamin I'd like you to talk about. And if you can't make niacin, you go through this whole pathway called the quinolinic acid pathway, and that creates, that's like a brain toxin. So it's almost like your body is trying to do the right thing, but it has to make this really interesting toxin before it. And all we have to do is maybe take a little extra niacin, and you know, things might straighten out for us. So tell us a little bit about, you know, what the functional medicine theory is on mental illness.
Well, in your last 3 minutes, what you just described could revolutionize the field of psychiatry. And just so frightening that the information is available. So we've been, you know, the gliadorphin and casomorphine, it is a simple urine test. And we've treated kids with autism to adults with OCD, as you describe. And if we could do that, and if our traditional mental health treatment model understood that, we would help a lot of individuals. And then you mentioned quinolinic acid, a simple molecule we can detect in a urine test, and it reflects neuroinflammation and abnormal pathways in the brain that also can be treated. Niacin is one example of that. So there are just so many really basic, well kind of organized biochemical theories that could change how we treat mental illness, which is, everyone knows, is increasing, and our model is just not effective. And it's just frustrating that this information is not available or accepted by our traditional medical community.
So why is that? Is that, you know, I mean, is it really politics and money? I mean, that's what we, conspiracy theorists, you're an old hippie from the tank, I guess.
Well, I think we have to always go with the money theory and the pharmaceutical industry, which is pretty powerful. And we've certainly seen that with the opiate crisis. But yeah, some of the interventions, niacin might cost pennies a day. You know, vitamin D or fish oil, zinc might cost pennies a day. And there's no kind of financial incentive for anyone to do research. And that research is what guides medicine. So finances are part of it. But there's also a term I've used off and on for years called the tomato effect. And it was written by two physicians just describing why effective treatments that are too simple for the medical model don't work. And this is based on that for 200 years, we wouldn't eat tomatoes in this country because we thought they were poisons from the nightshade family, like 1600 to 18 something.
Wow.
And our medical model, you know, a vitamin is too simple. Giving up gluten is too simple. So it's got to be a drug, or it's got to be surgery. It's got to fit that medical paradigm that we, you know, function under. And that's sad for people struggling with depression and anxiety and lots of other mental health problems.
So tell us a little bit about like your journey afterwards. So here you are in medical school treating people with the psychopharmacology. Did you find it helped people for a while and then it stopped working? What's going on with the drug model and why doesn't it seem to work?
Well, as a child psychiatrist, I, you know, certainly landed most of the patients coming in with ADHD and quickly, you know, developed a nutrition-based model for understanding and treating ADHD. And then, you know, over the years, helping people understand all the major mental illnesses, I haven't thrown away my prescription pad. There is a role for medicine, but it is second and third kind of choices after we look at nutrition, we look at life. You mentioned David Burns and our thoughts and our history of trauma. There's so many factors contributing to our mental health, and our goal is to train clinicians to understand those. It's not just a prescription, and the prescription-based model is really people just taking a list of symptoms and using a symptomatic-based model that just gives an antidepressant for everyone who's sad. And you might be sad for 10 reasons. It could be a thyroid problem, it could be a loss, it could be a B12 deficiency. So we need to look at the underlying cause, and that's really the what I call the functional psychiatry model.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's, and I know you're actually launched an educational platform, which is out there to kind of help maybe psychiatrists with CME approved courses. Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah, in an effort to make this information available to clinicians, doctors, and nurses, and therapists, we set up Psychiatry Redefined as a educational platform. So we have lectures by professionals, and many of the courses are CME approved. So we have research supporting all the information, and it's set up along different courses, depression, 4 or 5 hours on a integrative and functional model. So for depression, anxiety, currently there's probably over 150 hours of content. And our goal really is to just re-educate, redefine how we think about mental health and mental illness.
You talked about working a lot with ADHD children. I remember years ago, myself too, was involved in that whole explosion when they kind of labeled that. And who knows if I would have been labeled that as a kid based on some of the letters that I got written home from that my mother kept in a, still keeps in an envelope when I get out of line. That's kind of funny. But nonetheless, why, you know, how did that become a psychiatric condition? I remember there was not even a diagnostic code for that at one point in the late 80s, early 90s, and then it morphed into an illness and then different theories. What's your thoughts on why kids behave like that? I know it's so multifactorial, but let's go through some of them.
Yeah, I mean, the ADHD book we wrote, Finally Focus, kind of uses a model, we call it the plus minus plan, looking at the underlying cause. There are some kids that have, you know, we've heard about the lead in the water in Flint, Michigan, but, you know, heavy metals like lead, more common we see is high copper, you know, can create behavior problems and attention problems, food allergies, nutritional deficiencies, magnesium being the most prominent. So there's a wide range of metabolic and nutritional factors that can affect, you know, attention and behavior. But early on, we just labeled anybody that didn't fit, you know, our model of the perfect student as having a diagnosis and started prescribing amphetamines. And that has just continued to increase as more and more drug companies develop fancier, you know, medications that are all amphetamine-like molecules. but many, many kids now are taking medications for ADHD, where often there's an underlying treatable cause.
Yeah. So how does that? How does the Ritalin and all those different types of drugs, that was the granddaddy of those things, how do they actually work? Like, how does, like, this is interesting. How does giving a speedy kid speed slow them down? That's a good.
It's a great question. And the simplest way I describe it to parents and kids is that it actually speeds up the brakes in your brain to help you kind of inhibit, you know, thoughts and behaviors and impulses. And we know the mechanism quite well in terms of increasing dopamine, a neurotransmitter in the brain. And the medicines do work. So I'm not opposed to medications, but I think using amphetamines, they're really just band-aids. They only work when you take them. So when they're out of your system, you still have all the symptoms of ADHD. So the goal is really to look at the underlying cause, try to treat it, and only use medicines if someone is really struggling in some aspect of their life, either school or socially.
Yeah, so when kids are acting out like that, then they also get kind of like labeled, and they get, you know, sit in the old days, put the dunce cap on. So it creates a whole psychosocial issue too, right?
Absolutely. There's, I always give my talks on ADHD, the slides I talk with is untreated ADHD. We have higher incidences of financial loss, divorce, car accidents, are almost as high as someone intoxicated, employment problems, relationship problems. So untreated, you know, it's a real disorder, but we can treat it with many different approaches other than just medications. So those that struggle with ADHD need to be both understood and treated, and counseling and biological interventions are all helpful. Medicine is just a band-aid that does not treat the underlying cause.
So it's sort of like very individualized medicine and approach, which I think is brilliant. Of course, it's not an algorithm, you know, which I think medicine is looking for, this type of algorithmic approach to illnesses, like a nice, smoothly worked key sliding into a particular door, opening the lock and curing the illness. But people don't fit into these. They're very individual. There's a plethora of dietary things. I mean, not everyone should be on the same diet. You were eating kale and brown rice. I wonder if you developed nutritional deficiencies too as a college student. I know I did. Because I did the same thing, probably
the same age.
So,
yes, no, absolutely. I think your point of everyone's different is the whole kind of focus of my work, and the mnemonic we used in our depression book was called the zebra approach, and I use the term zebra throughout a lot of my work because of the individual stripe patterns. Every zebra has a different stripe pattern to just remind people that we're all different. There are some people that can do well in a vegetarian diet, and many people can't. And our nutritional needs vary from, you know, dosages of vitamin D to vitamin C. So that kind of personalized approach is the only way to address mental illness, but it's complicated. It's more work than a 15-minute med visit. And that's challenging for our medical community.
And then you have this old age-old concept that was talked about by, Ayurvedic doctors and, you know, many doctors throughout the eons of time of medicine with, I guess the way we always say it in naturopathic medicine is, you are what you absorb. It's like an ancient aphorism. I wonder who developed that, but whether it was Hippocrates or someone even more ancient than that, but so one of the big things is not only just is the diet deficient in so many micronutrients, which we'll go through a few of them, I think, that we should talk about, because, you know, I've also been in the field for 40 years or so now, and have seen just reproducible nutrients that are just always low in everyone I test. I mean, it's just ridiculous. But this whole concept of you are what you absorb, tell us a little bit about the thinking behind that and how that ties into the gut.
Sure. We see a lot of patients who are eating the perfect diet. They're, you know, flying in fish from Alaska and grass fed this. And then we do the testing and they're profoundly nutritional deficient because exactly what you said, they're not absorbing the nutrients. So for depression and anxiety and fatigue, we see this very often that individuals are nutritional deficient unrelated to dietary intake because they don't have enough digestive enzymes, hydrochloric acid in the stomach. And this could be due to either nutritional deficiencies of zinc, or it could often, we've seen it associated with trauma and stress, where the digestive system just shuts off. It doesn't matter what they're eating. As you said, they're not absorbing their nutrients.
And that includes their amino acids too, because I've done the same thing, Dr. Greenblatt. I've actually run, I'm sure you do all the time, different amino acid tests. And here's a person that's, you know they're eating plenty of protein. And yet when you run these tests, it's almost as if they're living in a developing, starving nation. It's like, where is the fuel coming from to build their muscles, to make neurotransmitters, to make the catecholamines, which are the, some of the thinking molecules that maybe you can go over, to make the serotonin and other types of, neurotransmitters. So it starts with, like you said, absorption. That's the first thing we always, as naturopathic doctors, I mean, Dr. Bastier and Dr. Mitchell and some of the pioneers, Dr. Pizzorno, would always talk about chewing your food and not, good food combining and not, there was an old time naturopath called Fletcher who used to, his whole lectures, I have all his old lectures were about chewing your food and not eating quickly in a rush, and eating mindful. All that plays a big role, I'm sure, in health, right? Because not only are you low in nutrients, but don't you get undigested food particles, which then can feed like the hordes of abnormal microbes living in the colon?
Yes. One of the ways that I've stayed in traditional medicine about 25 years ago, I started working in the field of eating disorders. So I was working with patients with anorexia and bulimia and binge eating. And I could talk to my colleagues about nutritional deficiencies because patients were very profoundly malnourished. But when you talk about absorption, so we would test our patients with anorexia and some of their amino acid levels were better than our patients who were eating the steak and the salmon and the healthy foods because they lacked these digestive enzymes. So our ability to test is critical to treat. And that amino acid test you mentioned is one of the most important tests that I use as a psychiatrist to help people understand if they have these basic building blocks to build the neurotransmitters that you're describing.
Yeah, you are what you absorb. And so would you give people different enzymes and eating strategies to mastication strategies, things like that to help people?
Yeah, well, I mean, we use a lot of amino acids. So rather than like telling them to eat more protein or even whey protein, we use some free form amino acids. So just the essential amino acids in a powder is the most helpful because they feel better very quickly. And then supporting their digestion with digestive enzymes, particularly making sure hydrochloric acid, which starts the whole process in the stomach, is in the digestive enzyme. So the free form amino acids and the hydrochloric acid is kind of jump-starting those individuals that are malnourished due to this protein, and then, you know, testing guides the rest of our treatment. Are they deficient in magnesium or zinc? Do they have a gut, you know, dysbiosis problem? Everyone's different, even though the symptoms might all look like depression.
Right. So we're going to take a quick break. It's getting to be towards the middle of the hour, and we're going to play one of our natural medicine chest mini modular programs. And when we come back, we're going to talk about more of Dr. Greenblatt's 3 decades of practice and research, and he's the founder of Psychiatry Redefined. I have a lot more questions to ask about some micronutrients and things like that, and some of the research of, like, maybe Dr. Hoffer and some of the orthomolecular psychiatrists. I wanted to touch base on those types of questions, and then anything else Dr. Greenblatt wants to share. So stay with us, folks.
On this edition of the Natural Medicine Chest, we'll discuss the nutrient known as taurine.
Amino acids are chemical constituents that form the building blocks of protein in the body. The official definition of an amino acid is a compound which contains an amino group and a carboxylic acid. Taurine contains a sulfonic group instead, so is not a true amino acid, although it is often referred to as one. The intracellular concentration of taurine is 10 times that of any normal free amino acid.
Taurine was discovered in 1827, but the significance of taurine in nutrition was not realized until 1975, when the journal Science published a study showing that taurine-deficient cats suffered from retinal degeneration. In 1986, the Annual Review of Biochemistry reported that the amount of taurine present in mammalian milk depends on the species. Natural human mother's milk is rich in taurine, but cow's milk, except for the early milk known as colostrum, is taurine deficient. Pediatrics Journal in 1983 printed a study which outlined several of the biologically significant functions of taurine, and an effort was then made to fortify infant formula by adding taurine.
Some species of animals, such as cats, cannot synthesize taurine within their bodies, and so must receive it through their diet. Humans have a very limited ability to synthesize taurine, so adequate intake through diet and supplementation is important. The principal source of dietary taurine is meat of various types and shellfish. Even people ingesting sufficiently high levels of taurine may develop a deficiency due to the overgrowth of certain anaerobic intestinal microorganisms which consume taurine. Certain prescription drugs are known inhibitors of taurine uptake.
The Journal of Neurochemistry published a study in 1975 which showed that taurine concentrations are extremely high in the retina. In fact, the retina contains 2 binding proteins specific for taurine. Research has yet to determine exactly how taurine functions in the eye, but deficiency of taurine has been found to lead to the degeneration of photoreceptor cells. Continued studies on taurine have linked its presence to several biological functions, besides being a protector of the delicate tissues of the eye. Taurine helps to neutralize oxidizing agents caused by ionizing radiation. Taurine is present in high concentrations in the normal heart. It stimulates white blood cell motility and protects cell membranes from free radical damage. Taurine has proven useful in epileptics to reduce or control seizures. It helps modulate the transport of substances such as sodium, potassium, magnesium, copper, and iron across cell membranes. Additional research supports taurine's role in preventing gallstones.
So, as you can see, the nutrient taurine may be an important addition to your natural medicine chest.
And that brings us back to our wonderful program here with our topic, Nutritional Interventions in Psychiatry and Mental Illness, with Dr. James Greenblatt. He's a pioneer in the field of integrative medicine and educator, author. He's lectured internationally, written a lot of books. We've touched base on a few of them here already. And he is the founder of Psychiatry Redefined, an educational platform dedicated to the transformation of psychiatry, offering online CME-approved courses, webinars, and fellowships for professionals to learn about functional integrative medicine for mental illness. Welcome back, Doc.
Thank you.
Hey, we talked a little bit about allergies. So that's a whole Pandora's box, because when we're talking about allergies, or when a functional doctor is talking about allergies, we're talking more about, I guess, what a conventional allergist would say would be sensitivities, or what the old time doctors like Dr. Doris Rapp, Wrinkle, Randolph, I forgot the other one, another R, cerebral allergies, they called them, all the clinical ecologists. How does eating food affect your brain?
Well, I mean, pretty dramatically, and certainly for children. The other college adventure I had was working, I don't know if you remember the name, Marshall Mandel, who was an allergist in Connecticut, who looking at, like Doris Rapp, looking at how foods affected behavior. And I spent 6 weeks in his office observing. And, you know, they would give these little droppers of clear liquids with different food substances, and some might add peanut butter or strawberries. And I just witnessed, again, a college student, not a physician, I'd witnessed behavior changes and mood changes and handwriting changes just by drops under their tongue of these foods they were allergic to. So in my practice, I have found food allergies to be very significant for young kids, the autistic kids, the ADHD kids. You know, over the adolescents, the adults, you know, I find it as occasionally important, but certainly not as dramatic as we see in some of the younger kids. And it's not always dairy and wheat. It could be tomatoes. It could be certain nuts. So the testing is really important, and eliminating those foods can result in behavioral changes.
Yeah, and fairly quickly too. It's pretty amazing to read those books. Like one of the classics was "Is This Your Child?" by, of course, Dr. Rapp, where you can actually see they can induce the malfunction of the brain. I guess the quote unquote. I think they called them cerebral allergies. Is that kind of what's happening here, or what do you think?
Yeah, that's the term that was used. It's hard to know the mechanism. It's not the immediate hypersensitivity that you get when you have hives or, you know, swelling of a lip. It's called delayed hypersensitivity. So it's a different immunoglobulin, the IgG. And it appears that the food immune complex crosses the brain and does affect behavior, and not exactly sure how. But by eliminating these foods, we see huge differences.
Yeah, very interesting. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the nutrients that I mentioned before that seem to be pretty low in our United States diet. I remember when I was in naturopathic school, Dr. Joe Pizzorno talking about that. He showed us this document from 1939, I think it was. Maybe 1937, which talked about that from the USDA saying that already there's no chromium in the soil. And this was kind of like a warning letter saying that if we don't, you know, change our farming practices, that there's not going to be any chromium in people. And that's one of those minerals that, I don't know if you had this experience, Dr. Greenblatt, but that I have seen hardly be normal in anyone, including myself, who takes a tremendous amount of chromium. I mean, I've finally got it to a level that I think is acceptable. But that's one of the many trace elements that I think has to do with certainly, you know, blood sugar regulation. And I think blood sugar has a lot to do with how we behave. Am I right?
Yes. I mean, chromium is one example, and certainly blood sugar abnormalities is very common in kids with ADHD. It's never addressed. It's never looked at, but it's common. These kids don't regulate the blood sugar. There was an early study done at Yale where the ADHD kids blood sugars dropped lower because they didn't produce, you know, the hormones to regulate their blood sugar. And chromium often is one of the deficiencies that can help regulating blood sugar. But the farming practices were depleted the soil of many, many nutrients. And these kids are eating processed foods. And even the healthy foods, as you describe, are devoid of nutrients because the soil is devoid of nutrients.
Yeah, we have to get. So what? How do you get kids to eat better? You know, I have of course grown kids myself, and it was a challenge, that's for sure. And even in my practice working with younger children and parents just banging their heads against the wall in frustration, you know, that's a whole other, I guess, topic of discussion. But, you know, behavior does play a role, and compliance does play a role in how well kids, and some kids can't swallow big horse pills, big vitamins and minerals. So we have to come up with other innovative solutions for them to get to the nutrition. Can you share any kind of cool cases that you've had where you've been able to figure out how to get these kids onto a decent diet?
Well, I think the biggest problem I've found is parents pushing too hard, you know, having their kids take 6 or 7 supplements, and they might do it for 3 days and then just give up. So the key, particularly for these young kids, is to, you know, prioritize, and magnesium is often the most important for ADHD. So just pick a couple and help them kind of see the difference, that they're sleeping better, they're feeling better. And then often you can add the second and the third supplements. And then, you know, having enough delivery system. Yes, having enough, you know, some you can use liquids or powders, and just engaging the child.
What's your theory on how changing the glucose levels in the brain affects the behavior?
Well, I think we know blood sugar affects both, you know, eating behaviors, and with ADHD, there was early research in the 90s showing that children with ADHD were unable to regulate their blood sugar similar to non-ADHD individuals. So both chromium and other nutrients that affect blood sugar, I believe, has a significant role for ADHD. There was a woman who did her PhD thesis and just did 100 glucose tolerance curves on ADHD's kids. And what she was able to demonstrate is none of them were normal. They were all varying degrees of abnormality, but none of them had a typical curve. So blood sugar regulation with dietary interventions like minimizing refined sugar is critical for treating ADHD.
What about really serious? Not that these aren't serious. Any disorder, of course, is very life-altering and can be serious. But I'm talking about, you know, bipolar disorders, schizophrenia, things like that. I mean, these are folks that have more serious conditions, I would think. Have you found that orthomolecular psychiatry or your psychiatry redefined can be very helpful for even these types of cases?
You know, absolutely. The schizophrenia, which is a serious progressive neuropsychiatric illness, we're finding nutritional deficiencies, we're finding abnormal reactions to gluten, we're finding infections and mold. There's a whole host of medical conditions that mimic psychosis and schizophrenia that are now being looked at in research. So I think some of our major psychiatric illnesses are very amenable to these orthomolecular and functional medicine approaches. You know, bipolar illness is a little different because it's a genetic vulnerability. Lithium as a medication is profoundly helpful, but long-term lithium can have side effects. So what our approach is a functional integrative approach. Once someone is stable, can really minimize relapse and enable someone to minimize the dose of medications that could cause side effects. So long-winded way of saying, Yes, even the major psychiatric illnesses, bipolar and schizophrenia, can be addressed in a functional medicine approach.
You know, Dr. Jonathan Wright writes a lot about lithium as a mineral versus a psychiatric drug. Can you, that would be an interesting side topic for the listeners, I think, because we've talked about that on the show. Can you tell us a little bit about that very interesting mineral, and do you have any feedback on using it as a trace element versus a very high dose drug?
Yes, actually, I worked with Jonathan Wright for years, and lithium, nutritional lithium, is probably my passion project. We have two books on it, and we've put on an international conference on
really?
Low-dose lithium. Yes.
I have to get it. I have to check that out to train my naturopathic students. I'll have to. Is that on your website, Dr. Greenblatt?
Yes. So, we'll send you the link for the conference. Was the highlight of my career is on nutritional lithium. So we had experts from around the globe who've done research on everything from, again, this trace mineral affecting suicide, affecting traumatic brain injury, cancer, Parkinson's, and certainly dementia is where most of the research is done. But lithium, as you alluded to, it's a trace mineral. It's in our soil. It's in our water supply. And these trace amounts of lithium is essential for brain function. And the research that spans almost a half a century now has demonstrated the amount of lithium in our drinking water affects mental illness and mental health problems. So what scientists have started looking at is, could low doses, microdoses, 1 to 5 milligrams of lithium, affect things like preventing Alzheimer's, affect things like suicide prevention? And the research is coming back quite emphatically saying yes.
So it's definitely like Dr. Wright talked about, the misunderstood mineral, that's for sure.
Absolutely. It is a essential mineral for brain function. And I believe we have genetic differences in how much we need. So families, and I learned this from Dr. Wright, the family histories with substance abuse and suicide and violence going back 2 or 3 generations, they likely have higher needs of lithium. So adding a little lithium as a nutritional supplement can really prevent some of these behaviors.
It's funny, it seems to be in certain pockets of the United States that there's not a lot of lithium in the groundwater. And then if you go up to, like, I don't know, the mountains in Idaho and you can get that mountain water, that you get better levels of that. I remember once I was reading this article about that the Texas governor wanted to put it in the water as like almost like putting fluorine in the water because of its potential effect on preventing people from becoming criminals. Did you remember reading that study?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And there was big kind of controversy because people just associate lithium with, you know, a drug, and people did not want the support. But the research does kind of lean towards adding a lithium to the water of some communities could really prevent rates of mental illness and more significantly suicide. The most significant research on lithium is suicide prevention, and we have studies around the globe, I think 15 different countries, millions of patients in these research studies, and the results are all the same. The higher amount of lithium in the drinking water, lower rates of suicide.
You do get kind of dirty looks when, you know, folks either request your chart notes or whatever, and you say that you have people on lithium. I remember once, you know, I had to testify in some type of a court case, and, you know, people were looking at me like, wow, why does this guy have people on lithium? So it still has this unfortunate mystique as being this high dose. What's the drug? The lithium carbonate, Dr. Greenblatt, versus the orotate?
Correct. The prescription is lithium carbonate. The supplement is usually lithium orotate. But I think what we found over the past few years is that it's really not the carrier molecule, it's the amount of lithium. So you can get small amounts of lithium carbonate, like one pill of lithium carbonate only has 28 milligrams of lithium. And I know traditional doctors that take that one pill for the prevention of dementia, because the research is so clear that lithium can help prevent cognitive decline.
Wow, that's, did you hear that, folks? I mean, we're entering into a time where, you know, where they're looking for the next greatest Alzheimer's drug, and there's been one of them. You know, my son was working for some company. I mean, he does a lot of the website and stuff, but, and it was a total bust. They invested billions of dollars into this thing, and the FDA turned it down because it didn't show any clinical efficacy. What a simple thing, like going to a functional medicine, integrative medicine doctor and getting some different tests and possibly preventing dementia. What a sad thing to see your relatives suffer from it. We have personal family experience with that. So yeah, it's really refreshing to have you on, Dr. Greenblatt, and talk about this stuff here. Anything you wanted to share towards the tail end of the program here? We got about maybe 6 minutes to go, 7 minutes.
Yeah, just on that point, the on our website, I believe there's a free ebook looking at cognitive decline and discussing the lithium. So on psychiatrydefined.org, there should be a sign up for a free ebook discussing some of these very simple functional medicine approaches and the research to support nutritional lithium.
Well, that's great. I'm going to recommend that because I'll be teaching anti-aging this semester at the University of Bridgeport to my fourth year naturopathic students, and we'll have them read that because we do a whole section on the brain and, you know, of course, Dr. Brendison's work and, you know, looking at different, what we can do for multifactorial viewpoint of dementia and so many other illnesses. It seems like that's the issue, is that medicine has got in this paradigm of like one drug, one bug, one pill, one ill type of idea. And you've thrown out that these illnesses, imbalances have to do with a myriad of things. And that's where the skill is, because doctors aren't trained in looking at all these laboratories and understanding that all of these different imbalances can lead to this malady or illness. And so I think that's the big disconnect in medicine today. What do you think about that?
I think you're right. I think if we take an integrative or functional medicine approach to mental health, it's more complicated. It's more work for the doctor. And there's not a pharmaceutical drug with a simple solution. And that's why I think we really have to start with training doctors and clinicians to think in a bigger model, looking at underlying causes and kind of respecting these individual differences that we've talked about.
It's almost like you have to understand a little bit about these other fields that you didn't really specialize in. I mean, you didn't specialize in the gut. You decided to go for a specialty in psychiatry. You didn't specialize in endocrinology, looking at, you mentioned thyroid and how that can affect. How about the adrenals, Dr. Greenblatt? We didn't even talk about that. Too bad, we're running out of time. You know, when the adrenals are off, that can lead to so many problems, including cases of anxiety that I've been able to help out with balancing the adrenal glands and getting people out of the fight or flight response. And then our very show that we played in between break before we lost power a little bit there on taurine, talk about an amazing amino acid that kind of calms the brain down. There's so many approaches to anxiety as well. Anything that you could share with the listeners?
Yeah, I think most important thing is that everyone's different. But as we look at individuals, we will find many of the solutions, you know, in your kind of naturopathic world to be based on nutritional deficiencies, metabolism, the gut. And then, you know, we can't forget, you know, psychological health, and certainly trauma is so overlooked and undertreated in our society. And that's where it comes back to the adrenals, because psychological stress just, you know, drains the adrenal glands to a point where there's hormonal deficiencies and then nutritional deficiencies. And if we can treat those, we can have some balance, some biological foundation, and then utilize psychotherapy and other modes of treatment. But we need a biological foundation first.
Yeah, and that's where this, learning, going to doctors. Are there organizations of psychiatrists that are kind of like yourself for listeners that live all across the country here?
Not really. And that's the sad part. That's the reason we started Psychiatry Redefined. So we are gathering community of psychiatrists, and there are growing numbers of integrative and functional medicine psychiatrists looking for answers beyond just the prescription. So the good news is people are interested in this work, and hopefully we'll be training more and more doctors over the next couple of years.
So you have a Facebook page, and tell us about the different books that you have out there in the last few minutes of the program.
Sure. The books are all on my website, jamesgreenblattmd.com. And we slowly addressing most of the major psychiatric illness. So ADHD is called Finally Focused, anorexia, binge eating, depression, Alzheimer's, and the lithium book, The Cinderella Story. And these look at a functional medicine approach to mental health.
Great. Well, thanks very much, Dr. Greenblatt, for your being a pioneer in this field. And like I said, I have great respect. One of my first teachers was Dr. Serafina Corsello, who was, I'm not sure if you know Dr. Corsello, but she was an Italian-born psychiatrist and became functional medicine doctor, one of the original FAME members. And she worked in Huntington and New York City, and unfortunately, the medical establishment kind of had their way with her, and she fought bitterly to try to, keep holistic thinking in medicine. And unfortunately, New York was very draconian in the way that they treated her. But nonetheless, I hope that we have more doctors like yourself to kind of help people with mental illness. I guess I wanted to end that mental illness often is shrouded in second classism compared to physical illness. What's your feelings on that? You can go out with that thought.
Well, I think a lot has changed in the last couple of years, maybe the last two or three years, where I think the shame and stigma of mental illness has shifted. People are talking about it. People are getting treatment. Athletes, celebrities. That's the good news. The sad news for me is the treatment model hasn't changed dramatically to a functional integrative approach, but at least the awareness has grown and the stigma is there, but much less. So there's hope. I'm very hopeful that we can develop a model for treating mental illness that's both kind of humanistic and effective.
Thank you so much. Well, that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. Remember, Dr. Greenblatt's psychiatryredefined.org website and his educational platform, something to look at. We really enjoyed this conversation, Dr. Greenblatt. Have a wonderful day and Happy New Year.
Really appreciate your questions and knowledge in the field. So thank you very much. Happy New Year to you.
You too. And we'll see you soon, everyone. And we want you to stay healthy on behalf of myself and the Natural Nurse. Happy New Year, everyone. Take care. Bye.